This is Miss Melis, the bathtub mermaid, and you're listening to Tales from the Tub. Hey there, bathtub merfolk, and any new listeners. I know it's been a minute since you've heard from me. Okay, many, many minutes. Okay, it's been since December. But I have missed you, and I promise I have not been idle. Tonight, in fact, I have three stories with two incredible readers joining me, so let's not waste any more time on the preamble. Our first story tonight is Salt Logic, read by Paul Maki. It's a story about a retired NOAA scientist whose buoys start sending him apologies.
The ocean started apologizing on a Wednesday. It was halfway through reheating yesterday's chowder when the first buoy pinged. It wasn't unusual. Equipment hiccups, rogue currents, barnacle interference. What caught my attention was the rhythm. Dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dash, dot. Morse. Old habits die hard. I still keep a code sheet taped to the fridge, a souvenir from my early NOAA days, before satellites made men like me mostly decorative. The message spelled, "Sorry." I muttered, "For what?" And the microwave dinged as if answering. Retirement had been my idea, though my department head called it strategic downsizing. I consult part-time now, checking data feeds from buoys scattered along the main coast. The system runs itself mostly, but I like to think it appreciates a human witness. The next morning, another ping. Sorry again. I sent a diagnostic request, assuming a frequency overlap from the Coast Guard channel, but the server replied clean. No interference detected. By Friday, the pings had multiplied. They weren't random. They were conversational. The pattern came from several decommissioned buoys, units I'd deployed 20 years ago. They hadn't transmitted in over a decade. The messages shifted tone. Please, listen. I poured coffee, black and briny as the sea air, and said to the empty kitchen, "I'm listening." I told myself it had to be a prank, some ham radio hobbyist with too much time and a flair for the dramatic. I posted on a forum, casual-like, asking if anyone else's coastal feeds were acting up, and the silence that followed felt like an answer. That night, the fog came in heavy, thick enough to muffle the world. I opened the window a crack to hear the boys calling, long tones drifting over the water. "I took too much," they said. "I don't know how to give back." I laughed then, a short bark that startled me. "You and me both." The fog swallowed the sound. I drove down to the pier the next day, checking the harbor sensors manually. The air smelled like kelp and gasoline. Fishermen nodded as I passed, men who measured time in tides, not hours. One of them called out, "You see in the glow out by Bartlett Reef?" "Bioluminescence," I said automatically. He spat into the water. "Funny. Glows in daylight, too." I didn't answer. The coordinates lined up with one of the old boys, the one that had first said sorry. Back home, I replayed the data. The signal wasn't simple Morse anymore. It carried harmonics, layers of tone outside normal acoustic range. When I slowed it down, the pattern formed something like a heartbeat. I should have been excited. Instead, I felt tired, the kind of tired that gets behind your ribs and hums. My ex-wife once said I had two emotions, analysis and avoidance. She wasn't wrong. But curiosity is a hell of a drug. I packed my field recorder, rented a dinghy, and headed out before dawn. The water was calm, deceptive as a mirror. The buoy loomed ahead, orange paint faded to rust, solar light still blinking. I cut the motor and drifted close. The sea was strangely warm, not tropical, but body temperature. I tapped the buoy casing. "You wanted me here. Now what?" The speaker crackled once, then settled into a low hum. Not mechanical, musical. Phosphorescence bloomed around the hull, not blue but green-white, swirling in time with the hum. It wasn't random light, it was pattern. Waveforms writ in motion. For a moment, the ocean looked back at me. No eyes, no face, just the sense of being regarded. Gently, curiously, like I was a specimen it didn't quite understand. Then through the water, the vibration changed. Words formed not in sound, but pressure. A resonance inside my chest. You listened. I dropped the recorder. It hit the deck with a clatter. When I came to, yes, came to, because at some point I'd apparently fainted like a Victorian lady. The sky had gone orange-gray. The boy was silent. My watch said I'd lost 40 minutes. The sea looked normal again, except for the faint shimmer beneath the surface like heat mirage. I told myself I'd hallucinated. Dehydration, low blood sugar, wishful thinking. I was a scientist, damn it. The ocean doesn't apologize, and it doesn't talk back. Still, I logged the data. Frequency unknown. Amplitude variable. Subjective response. Awe. Mild panic. Gratitude. The next day, I found the recorder washed up on the beach below my house. It was bone dry, which should not have been possible. When I played it back, there was only static, until the final minute. A sound rose from the noise, deep and soft like a whale's call, slowed to human tempo. Then words, barely audible. You're part of us, always were. And then nothing. I deleted the file. Some truths are better as rumors. It's been 2 weeks since then. The boys are quiet. The weather reports are boring again. I pretend to be relieved. Sometimes, though, when the wind hits just right, I hear a tone under the gulls. Low, forgiving. I find myself answering without thinking, humming the way I used to when I was calibrating instruments. I find myself answering without thinking, humming the way I used to when calibrating instruments before I learned silence wasn't the same as peace. I've stopped trying to decode it. I just listen. Last night, I filed my final report. The field labeled cause of anomaly is blank. The conclusion reads, signal resolved, recommend no further investigation. I almost signed my name, then added a postscript, not for the agency, but for whoever or whatever reads between lines. Some questions don't need answers. Some things just need listening. The printer hummed as the page fed through, a perfect familiar pitch. I caught myself smiling. Apology accepted, I said. And the sea, patient as always, hummed its agreement.
Next up is Caffeine Theology, which is mine to read, and which is about what happens when a barista starts paying very close attention to how people order coffee. People think a cafe is about caffeine, but it's really about faith. Every morning, people line up at my counter believing I can make their day better in 12 ounces or less. Some pray with exactitude. 2 pumps of vanilla, oat milk, 130 degrees. And some surrender entirely. Whatever you recommend. Either way, they're confessing. I'm the high priestess of the espresso machine, and this is my church of small awakenings. The freshmen come in clutching their phones like rosaries, rehearsing orders from TikTok. A venti caramel thing with like cold foam, but make it dairy free because I'm trying to be mindful. They look terrified until I nod. I remember that fear, the kind you get when you're young enough to think everyone's watching. The professors order double espressos and talk too loudly about deadlines. They believe in bitterness as a virtue. Their cups are communion wafers of self-importance. They never tip, but they always compliment the crema as if that absolves them. There's the woman who orders decaf but still asks for extra shots, the theological version of wanting the ritual, not the repercussions, and the man who insists his cappuccino be authentic Italian. I use the same beans as everyone else, but I give him extra foam and a flourish on top. Religion, I've learned, is mostly presentation. My own faith used to be theater. I sang in choirs, wore robes, knew the difference between gospel truth and harmony. These days, I find more revelation in the hiss of steamed milk than I ever did in a sermon. The machine exhales like a tired god, and for a few seconds the world feels orderly. Every cup has a creed. The dark rose drinkers are stoics. The latte lovers, humanists. The frappuccino crowd believes in reincarnation because they come back 3 times a day. Then there's him, the grad student who always orders whatever you're having. I tried to scare him off with black coffee once. He drank it, winced, and said, "Bold choice." Next day he was back, same order, same grin that hovers between curious and reckless. I've started testing him. Macchiato, cortado, cold brew, cafe au lait. He drinks them all, uncomplaining. "You're learning about people," I said once. He shrugged. "You learn more by tasting than talking." I didn't ask what he was studying. He looks like philosophy or physics, one of those degrees that start with hubris and end with debt. Last week, he brought a friend who whispered, "That's her," like I was a myth. He laughed, embarrassed. "I'm writing my thesis about her," he explained, "about how choice defines consciousness." I told him that was the most pretentious thing anyone had ever said while wearing Vans. He said, "Maybe, but you inspired it." Now I'm hyper-aware of every cup I pour. Am I an example? A case study? A metaphor for free will? If he asks for whatever you're having, again, is that faith or laziness? This morning, he came in late. The rush was over, the cafe humming that peaceful afterglow that feels like exhalation. He took his usual stool by the window. "Whatever you're having," he said, smiling. I poured 2 cups of house blend with a splash of milk. Nothing fancy, just honest. "Sometimes," I said, "the theology is simple." He nodded, blue on the surface, sipped. "Perfect." The word hung between us, unearned and generous. After he left, I wiped the counter and thought about how people chase meaning in grand gestures, miracles, revelations, lightning bolts of certainty, when most of it's here in repetition. The steady ritual of boiled water and ground beans. The smell that promises you can try again. The cafe isn't a church. It's a heartbeat. Every morning, I unlock the door, grind the beans, prime the steamer, and listen to the world come back to life 1 sip at a time. That's enough belief for me. And finally, 15 minutes to showtime, about the charged, impossible stretch of time right before everything begins. Read by Jack Mangan.
The Stone Pony on Earth closed for good in 1998, or so they say. Technically, it reopened here, in orbit, 120 years later, because humanity can't let go of its favorite myths. Some venture capital type decided to recreate every legendary Earth venue in a ring-shaped station orbiting Mars. CBGB, Whiskey A Go-Go, the Fillmore, with a barrel of real apples. But the pony? That one's the crown jewel. Gravity set to a perfect 0.98 G, so you still feel your boots stick to the floor. And the bar smells faintly of beer, salt, and disinfectant. Nostalgia with a citrus finish. They kept the name, too. Stone Pony 2. The font's the same, neon tubes flickering by design, even though nothing on the station actually flickers anymore. And if you look out the portholes behind the stage, you can see the curve of Earth glowing like an amp light left on after load out. The tour buses may be interstellar shuttles now, and the roadies wear magnetic boots, but the bones of being in a band haven't changed. It's still equal parts exhaustion, duct tape, and ego management. And I've still got 15 minutes till showtime. 15 minutes. Green rooms haven't evolved either. This one's the same as every other. Peeling posters, half-dead couch, snacks that expired before the moon was colonized. Someone left a case of synth beer labeled Pony Pilsner, probably brewed in the same tank as the coolant. The sound tech pokes his head in to say, 10 till line check, which in musician time means eventually. There's an old photo of Springsteen on the wall. Original Earth era, smiling like the world hasn't gotten loud yet. I tap the frame for luck. Outside the airlock, I can hear the low hum of the crowd. It's not real air I'm breathing, just filtered atmosphere. but it's heavy with anticipation anyway. Maybe that's what rock and roll is now. Recycled oxygen, still managing to catch fire. 10 minutes. My bandmates are arguing about set order. The drummer wants to open with something fast. The bassist insists we save that one for last because it's the only one people remember. The singer, who's 23 and has never lived on Earth, suggests we cut both because slow songs are more emotional and partial gravity. I don't bother voting. I'm busy restringing my guitar. Even up here, the laws of physics still hate E strings. The tuner glows green and I grin. Old habits. I still use a manual pedal. Analog tech, no AI assist. The kids call it vintage. I call it trustworthy. A notification pings on my wristband. Set time confirmed. Stone Pony 2, main stage, 2100 hours. My pulse answers, just slightly off tempo. 5 minutes. There's a superstition we carry from planet to planet. Never say it's going to be a good show. That's a jinx. You can say loud, tight, on time, rarely true, but never good. I check my gear one last time. Amp hums steady, pedals lit, picks magnetized so they won't drift if someone kills the gravity mid-song, a lesson learned the hard way during a festival gig on Titan. The monitor tech floats by the door, grinning. Crowd's hyped, he says. They say someone from Springsteen's great-great-grand family's out there. Terrific, I say. Maybe they'll write us off on their taxes. He laughs and disappears down the hall. The room goes quiet. That's when it hits me. The same flutter it's always been, no matter the planet or century. The kind that makes you check your strings again, even though you just did. The kind that means you still care. 2 minutes. The guitarist from the opening act stops by to wish us luck. Kid can't be more than 19, hair the color of ambition, holding a borrowed Strat with duct tape across the pick guard. Man, he says, you guys are legends. I smile. In certain zip codes, sure. He stammers. No, really. My dad used to play your first record. Said it sounded like the future. That's ironic, I tell him. The future sounds like us covering the past. He laughs politely, not sure if it's a joke. Maybe it isn't. He floats back down the hall and I catch myself muttering, don't buy the cheap strings. Some advice transcends gravity. Showtime. The hallway to the stage is narrow and lined with holo posters that shimmer when you pass. CBGB at its peak, the Fillmore in color, the original Pony before the tides took Asbury Park. The air tastes faintly of metal and memory. The crowd noise rises, not a roar exactly, more like a heartbeat. The house lights dim, the stage lights ignite in blue-white arcs. My boots clack against the floor as I step out into the glow. The artificial gravity hums underfoot. The room tilts. Not physically, just that rush of recognition. We're on again. The singer counts us in. The drummer misses the downbeat by a microsecond, which means everything's perfect. The first chord hits. Loud, imperfect, human. It echoes through the hull, bouncing off the aluminum ribs of the station, traveling farther than sound was ever meant to. For a second, I can see Earth through the portholes, that thin blue curve, distant and soft. Down there, the original Pony's long gone, sand reclaimed by the sea. Up here, the noise keeps going, amplified by nostalgia and vacuum. I glance at my bandmates, old friends, new recruits, and a rotating cast of dreamers with calloused fingers. They're grinning like kids at their first gig. And I think, some things really don't change. The gear, the gravity, the crowd, all just variables. The constant is the noise we make, and the way it feels when someone out there sings along. The lights flare, the monitors hum, the room vibrates. I catch my reflection in the glossy curve of my guitar. Tired eyes, dumb smile. Someone in the front row yells a request for a song we haven't played in 20 years. I laugh into the mic. You got it, pal. Let's see if we remember the bridge. We don't. nobody cares. Because for the next hour, the universe contracts to the size of a stage. The crowd moves like a single heartbeat, and every old song sounds brand new again. And when it's done, when the feedback fades and the applause feels like gravity pulling me back, I grin and think. The lights came up, the crowd cheered like it mattered, and for the next hour, it did. That's enough.
You've been listening to The Bathtub Mermaid, Tales from the Tub. This podcast is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. For show notes, including links and references, please visit bathtubmermaid.com. Special thanks to our patrons, Nukchus, Susan, Jason, Clay, Charlotte and Ken, Selena, Mark, Fran, Patricia, and Steve. If you want to help keep the tub full, please consider joining them at patreon.com/bathtubmermaid. Remember, bubbles fade, but voices don't. Keep swimming and resist.